listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
The time now is 6 o'clock, and we want to welcome you to WORT's local news for Monday, April 14th, 2025. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
Tonight's news, prison reform advocates discuss key goals with lawmakers in the state capitol.
A measure to make guns safe tax-free has bipartisan support.
Plus, in the second half, we'll take a look at the meetings on local government's calendar. Remember one of the most violent strikes of the early 20th century, and review a new series and an old classic.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. Hundreds of thousands of people have now fled Sudan's biggest refugee camp, Zamzam, in Darfur, after RSF paramilitaries took control. The International Organization for Migration puts the number escaping at 400,000. The UN Women's Regional Director for Eastern Southern Africa, Anna Mutavati, told the BBC that there's been nearly a 300% increase in demand for services against sexual violence, rape and other forms of abuses that women and girls have been subjected to in Sudan since a year ago. But she warned that this was just the tip of the iceberg.
There are so many more cases that don't come to us or to our partners because families reject, they get ashamed by the violence, by the sexual violence, by the rape that the women in their lives have gone through. So there is that shaming and the stigma.
The president of El Salvador says he won't return to the US, a man mistakenly deported and jailed there as a gang member. Nayib Bukele said he didn't have the power to do so. He was speaking during a meeting with President Trump in the White House. Nomia Iqbal reports from Washington.
This was as friendly a meeting as you can get. And for President Trump, Nayib Bukele is central to his hardline deportation policy. When asked by reporters about the Maryland father, Kilma Abrego Garcia, who has wrongfully been deported to El Salvador's mega prison, both men were ideologically aligned. The Trump administration concedes it's an error and the Supreme Court has said he should be returned, but the U.S. refuses to climb down from its unsubstantiated claim that Mr. Garcia is a member of a gang designated a terrorist group. They say the ball is in El Salvador's court, but President Bukele said he wouldn't be releasing him from prison.
During that meeting, President Trump also told reporters that the Ukrainian leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, shares the blame for the millions of people dead with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. The US leader remarked that you don't start a war unless you know you can win it. There was widespread outrage over Russia's attack on Sumy on Sunday. Iraqi health officials say more than 1,800 people have been sent to hospital with respiratory problems after a sandstorm swept across central and southern parts of the country. Charles Haviland has the story.
One official in Mutana province reported to the French news agency at least 700 cases of what he said was suffocation. There were similar accounts from other provinces. In Najaf, a paramedic was seen helping a man gasping for air. Footage online shows areas cloaked in a thick orange haze. There are reports of several regions, including Basra and Najaf, enduring power cuts and the temporary suspension of flights. Sand or dust storms are common in Iraq and getting more so. Iraq's meteorological office blames drought, desertification and declining rainfall.
Charles Haviland reporting. World News from the BBC. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, has said the bloc has made it very clear to countries seeking membership that it doesn't want them to attend Second World War commemorations in Russia. Next month, Victory Day events will take place in Moscow to mark the 80th anniversary of the defeat of Nazi Germany. The Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, indicated last month that he planned to attend. His country is a candidate for EU membership, but he maintains close relations with Russia. Meta's founder Mark Zuckerberg has appeared in front of a US court to defend his social media company over accusations of creating a monopoly. From San Francisco, Lily Jamali reports.
Meta, which was then known as Facebook, purchased Instagram and then WhatsApp more than a decade ago. In court on Monday, the regulator said those acquisitions unlawfully quashed competition in the social media space and, quote, protected Meta's dominance. Meta says it has significant competition in social media, including from TikTok and X, formerly Twitter. And the FTC signed off on the acquisitions back when they took place. The FTC's case against Meta was brought during the first Trump administration. If the commission proves its case, Meta could one day be broken up by spinning off Instagram or WhatsApp or both.
More than 50 people are now known to have been killed in an attack by gunmen in Nigeria's Central Plateau state. Residents in the town of Zika say the attackers invaded in the early hours of Monday and started shooting indiscriminately. Women and children are reported to be the main casualties. The American rapper Sean Diddy Combs has pleaded not guilty to new charges in his long-running sex trafficking case. Earlier this month, he was hit with two new criminal charges, bringing the total number to five. He denies all of them, saying that he engaged only in consensual activities. That's the latest BBC News.
Good evening. This is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
The Wisconsin State Assembly is considering a new proposal that would make it easier for a candidate to withdraw from an election, reports Wisconsin Watch. The new proposal comes after two candidates tried to withdraw from an election before ultimately still having their name on the ballot. The first was Robert F. Kennedy Jr., running as an independent in the presidential election in November, and the second was Madison Alder Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford, running for a seat on the city council. Current Wisconsin law does not allow for candidates to withdraw their names from a ballot after qualifying, except in the case of the candidate's death. The new proposal would allow candidates to withdraw any time before the Wisconsin Elections Commission certifies candidate names. The proposal would only cover statewide and federal candidates. Local elections have a much shorter timeline, giving clerks less time to adapt ballots to changing circumstances.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court faces a series of cases involving environmental lawsuits, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. In the coming months, the court will decide a lawsuit brought by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Lobbying Group against the Department of Natural Resources, challenging their ability to require businesses to clean up their PFAS contamination. Another case making its way through the appeals court, challenging the DNR's ability to require concentrated animal feeding operations to obtain wastewater discharge permits. And yet another case in its early stages, a lawsuit brought by the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa challenging the permits issued to a nearby pipeline. The lawsuit's complicated nature makes it likely to reach the state Supreme Court eventually. The court retains its liberal majority following an election earlier this month. Newly elected Justice Susan Crawford will replace Ann Walsh Bradley on the court this coming August.
Meanwhile, Wisconsin has had a record winter for wildfires, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The state has already experienced more than 470 wildfires, more than double the average for this time of year. While this winter was not unusually warm, it was unusually dry, increasing the state's vulnerability to wildfires. Dry conditions are projected to continue into spring, making it likely that the high rate of fires will continue. As climate change continues to warm the state, Wisconsin is likely to be increasingly vulnerable to wildfires. In addition, researchers at UW-Madison have found that the number of homes that are close to wildland vegetation has grown by more than a third since 1990, making wildfires more dangerous and more costly.
New data from the United States Department of Agriculture shows that Wisconsin farmers have reduced the amount of soybeans they have planted this spring by about 12%, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The reduction in soybean planting is likely a response to an uncertain soybean market following the fluctuating tariff schedule put in place by the Trump administration. Around half of all soybeans are shipped out as exports, including large amounts that historically were shipped to China. In the first Trump administration, his trade conflict with China cost soybean farmers more than $19 billion in lost sales, and the soybean market pivoted towards production in South America, increasing the competition and driving down prices. Wisconsin farmers may be pivoting toward corn with a 5% increase in acres planted this year. Corn is less of an export crop, but it is often part of a rotation with soybeans, limiting farmers' ability to produce corn exclusively.
A bill in the Wisconsin State Assembly faced significant public pushback at its public hearing last Thursday, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. The new bill, which would require that Medicaid recipients verify their eligibility in the program twice a year, was only defended by the bill's author, State Representative William Penterman. Other witnesses outlined how the new requirement would be onerous for people enrolled in Medicaid, including those who require assistance to fill out paperwork. Around 20% of Wisconsinites are enrolled in Medicaid, a rate broadly in line with other states. A similar bill was proposed 2 years ago, but failed to pass the legislature.
An audit conducted by Wisconsin's Legislative Audit Bureau found that it is difficult to determine just how much spending in the University of Wisconsin system goes towards diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, reported the Associated Press. The audit, which was ordered by the Republican-controlled legislature, came up against the reality that there is no agreed-upon definition for DEI programs. The audit found that the university spent around $40 million on offices with duties connected to DEI, but that probably does not reflect the actual cost of DEI programs, as many of those offices had other duties as well. The UW system reached a deal with Republicans in the legislature in 2023, where the system would drop DEI initiatives in return for funding related to staff raises and construction projects. The school system has nearly half the number of positions that provide DEI services since then, according to UW System President Jay Rothman.
Meanwhile, UW System President Jay Rothman faced a contentious budget committee hearing as the Republican-controlled state legislature considers Governor Tony Evers' budget proposal, reports Wisconsin Watch. Evers' proposed budget includes $856 million in additional funding for the university system, a number that the legislature seems likely to target for cuts. In the hearing, Republicans accused the system of administrative bloat, as well as criticizing the admissions process at the UW campus. UW-Madison is also facing a precarious funding situation as the Trump administration disrupts research spending at the National Institutes of Health and other research agencies. Six employees were recently laid off due to federal research cuts, reports the Capital Times. The university also faces punitive investigations into its DEI programs and the pro-Palestinian protests on campus last year. Last month, Chancellor Jennifer Mnuchin asked all departments to develop plans for 5 and 10% budget cuts across the board.
Madison City Clerk Mary Beth Witzel-Bale resigned from her position today, according to a statement released by the city. Witzel-Bale's office is currently under investigation after it delayed informing the Wisconsin Elections Commission that it had misplaced a number of absentee ballots. Madison City Attorney Michael Haas will continue to serve as the acting clerk as the city moves to fill the vacancy. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Prison reform advocates are organizing around several goals this spring. Key among them, a shutdown of Wisconsin's oldest prisons. They shared those goals with lawmakers at the Capitol last Thursday. WORT reporter Shayna Clark was there.
Megan Hoffman Kolb started organizing with Wisdom Wisconsin 2 years ago. Her involvement is personal and came after her father died in prison.
Almost 2 years ago, in June 2023, I got the call that my dad, who had been incarcerated for just 80 days, passed away in a solitary confinement cell at Waupun Correctional Facility. After doing a deep dive as to what happened and what went on, I realized there was a big issue there, and it wasn't just him. It wasn't just what happened to my dad. It's a systemic issue. So I'm here today fighting for changes to our prison system statewide.
Kolb was one of hundreds of people at a Wisdom Advocacy Day at the state capitol last Thursday, ready to share with lawmakers the need for structural changes to incarceration in Wisconsin. Her father, Dean Hoffman, died in solitary confinement at Waupun Correctional Institution in June 2023 during a months-long lockdown. He's one of seven people to have died at the prison in the last 2 years. Like other advocates, Kolb says that living conditions in state prisons need to be improved. Everything from better drinking water, less crowding, and more access to recreation and programming. But Kolb's top issue is better access to mental health care, something she says her father deserved.
I want to see access, better access to mental health care and ensuring a doctor there, ensuring that these people are getting their medication. My dad was not given his medication as prescribed, so that first and foremost, I want them to be able to have access to a medical physician at a moment's notice when they are having a crisis, not sitting alone in a cell for days on end dealing with it on their own. And then just overall conditions of the prisons. It is a disgrace what we are making people live in. The water that they're having to drink, being stuck in their cells for 23 plus hours a day. I want to see those conditions changed for the better.
David Morrell is the prison outreach director for Wisdom and is currently serving out a 75-year sentence. He spent most of his 28 years in prison at Green Bay Correctional, which along with Waupun Correctional are the state's two oldest prisons. Both were built before 1900, and Morrell says aren't suitable to live in.
The mental anguish, right, to live in the room is no bigger than a closet, right? You can literally stand in the middle of the cell and put your arms out and you can't even straighten them out. And it's two people in this room, in this cell. And so that in and of itself suggests to me that it should be closed. But you would have to, well, it's hard for me to describe it. You know, someone has to actually be there and live there to know the torment that comes along with living there. So it definitely needs to be closed, definitely.
Governor Evers is proposing closing both of the prisons. His budget proposal includes a $500 million project to shutter Waupun and Green Bay Correctional. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have called to close the two aging prisons for years. A tougher sell, though, is not building a new one. That's one of the points advocates were here last Thursday to make.
Now! What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now! Like other decarceration advocates, Morrell's focus is on reducing the number of people held in prison in the first place.
I think, truthfully, if we look at statistics, most of the men and women who are currently incarcerated are back on crimeless revocations. They were out in the community at some point in time on some supervision, they messed up, and now they're back in prison. There's really no need for another prison if we deal with that.
60% of the more than 8,000 people sent to a prison last year involved revocation. Those are issued when someone on supervision is sent back to prison after they're found to have violated the terms of their release. That can include things like committing new crimes, but revocations can also be issued for violating any term of your supervision, like drinking alcohol, failing to report to a probation officer, or not following curfew.
If we can start treating these guys like human beings, instead of treating them like criminals, second-class citizens, then there won't be a need to keep building prisons after we close one. If we're really trying to be a society of reconciliation, then we don't want to continue to build up these monuments that advertise and advocate torture, right? We have enough prisons here in Wisconsin, and closing one is not going to hurt at all, especially if we start using some of our treatment alternatives and diversions that are being offered by some of these great grassroots organizations.
Prisons and jails are struggling with overcrowding and understaffing for a reason. The rate of people incarcerated in Wisconsin has grown dramatically since the 1980s, according to an analysis from the Prison Policy Initiative. Wisconsin also spends more money on corrections than most states. Spending on corrections has more than doubled since the 1990s, according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum. At $2.76 billion, the Department of Corrections gets the third largest share of the state's general revenue. Advocates with Wisdom say that instead of building new facilities, the state needs to fund alternatives like treatment and diversion programs.
People can change, just like I've changed, just like I've grown, just like I've been rehabilitated. There's men and women who are just sitting there rotting, who are ready to come home and contribute to society and to their families. So if I can give any one thing to anyone, is that people deserve second chances.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Shana Clark.
State Democrats held a press conference last week on a bill that would bring the question of campaign spending directly to Wisconsin voters. The bill would put a statewide referendum on the ballot in November of 2026, asking voters if Congress should overturn Citizens United. WORT reporter Elliot Hughes has the story.
We are not going to be bought. We don't want that money coming in here in Wisconsin to buy our elections and our freedom. So let's put this referendum on the ballots so voters can make their voices heard directly to Congress.
That's State Senator Jeff Smith, Democrat from New Brunswick, at a press conference last Thursday. He and other lawmakers are reviving legislation to undo Citizens United. That's the landmark 2010 Supreme Court decision that found that companies and unions have First Amendment rights to speech and, by extension, the right to spend freely on elections.
And effectively, what we're trying to do here is to overturn a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United by clarifying in our Constitution that money is not speech and corporations are not people. And what this does at the end of the day is it is a critical first step to getting big money out of politics.
Citizens United came with consequences. In the decade that followed, election-related spending from outside campaigns ballooned to $4.5 billion, according to a 2020 analysis from campaign finance watchdogs Open Secrets. State Representative Lisa Subek, a Democrat from Madison, is a co-author. She tells WORT this afternoon,
what we are trying to put on the ballot of the next general election is a referendum that would ask the citizens of Wisconsin if they would like our congressional representative to support a constitutional amendment to our federal constitution. And that amendment would state that corporations are not people and do not have the inalienable rights granted to people, and that money is not speech.
The bill comes just after the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election, which saw record campaign spending that doubled the previous record set in 2023. Outside groups spent more than $57 million this year, and total spending in the race clocked in at over $100 million. Some of that money comes from Elon Musk, who skirted campaign finance rules through a $1 million sweepstakes to those who signed a pledge. The state Supreme Court declined to hear a lawsuit filed by Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call, who argued the move violated state law that prohibits offering anything of value to sway a vote. Last Thursday, Smith denounced the move, calling Musk a carpetbagger.
Imagine what that money could do for the greater good. Honestly, let's be honest with ourselves. But everything that was said about what would happen after allowing unlimited money in politics has just come true. We've been trying to get this message across for a long time. The carpetbaggers like Elon Musk rolls into Wisconsin wearing a cheese head like he belongs, and we all know better than that, while handing out million-dollar checks. We do not want people to become accustomed to get paid to vote.
Subek says that this referendum has been introduced every session she's been in office. That's over a decade.
And the record that was set in our Supreme Court race didn't just set a new record. You know, it dwarfed the size of spending in the past. And, you know, we saw many fold that amount go up. And it is an alarming moment. I heard immediately, I mean, you know, throughout the election, but then certainly as the numbers started to come in post-election, heard from constituents that they're appalled by this, that this is obscene, and that our courts should not be bought and sold, that our courts should be held to a higher standard.
A survey released by the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, a nonprofit government watchdog, showed that just over 88% of Wisconsin voters are extremely or very concerned about the influence of money in politics. This legislation is largely symbolic. It's an advisory referendum, meaning the results aren't binding. It would only serve to gauge the opinion of voters. If approved, it would appear next year on the November ballot. Also on the ballot in fall 2026, the race for governor, attorney general, and state lawmaker. Subek says that campaign finance laws can't change until Citizens United is slashed.
So this is one thing that we can do to put pressure on our federal government to make that change, to say to our federal representatives, make a change, work on a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. Certainly, we have seen across the state local communities over the last 10 plus years pass referendum of their own, but we haven't had a statewide referendum, and people are asking for that. I also believe strongly that while there are other proposals that we will be bringing forward to address campaign financing, real campaign finance reform cannot happen without reversing Citizens United.
For WORT News, I'm Elliot Hughes.
A state assembly committee is slated to consider a bill tomorrow that would make gun safes tax-free. The bill has bipartisan support, but it skirts around actually requiring state safe storage. State Rep. Renuka Mayadev, a Democrat from Madison, is a co-author on the bill, and she spoke to Faye Parks about this measure.
Now, this bill would create a tax exemption for the sale of gun safes in our state. Worth noting, the Republican-authored bill has bipartisan support in both chambers of the state legislature. Why do you think that is? Outline the proposal's benefits for us.
Democrats are eager to do the right thing by Wisconsin's families and children by instituting common sense gun laws. This is, I guess, what I'd say a start. It tax exempts gun storage containers or gun storage safes. And that's a good start. And as you can see, as you mentioned, Faye, we have 26 Assembly Democrats on the bill. And we're enthusiastic because we want to do something. I mean, just recently at the end of last year, we had a school shooting here in Madison at the Abundant Life Christian School. And we have been clamoring to do something to protect our families and children. So this is a start.
Similar legislation has failed to pass in previous sessions. Do you expect a different outcome this time? If so, why?
You know, I did look at, in 2023, it was introduced by a Democratic colleague before I was in the Assembly. Now, the lead author is a Republican, Representative Nealon. And so I think that that makes a difference, that when a Republican can carry it, we'll hopefully see it come to the floor. Although there's another issue I'm very passionate about where Republicans are carrying the bill and that's not coming to the floor for postpartum coverage. But this, I hope, will come to the floor.
The State Department of Revenue estimated a $309,000 loss in tax revenue when they analyzed a similar proposal in 2019. Do you think that cost is a point of concern, or do you think it's worth it here?
Oh, no. I mean, that is nothing. That's a rounding error in our GPR numbers. This is about people's lives and the safety of children and families. And so there is no amount that is of concern when we're talking about the safety of our children.
In short, this bill would incentivize gun owners to lock up their firearms, not require it. The measure has support from an assortment of groups, including the League of Women Voters, WAVE Educational Fund, and Wisconsin Firearm Owners Incorporated, to name a few. Another group, Wisconsin Gun Owners Incorporated, is on the fence. In a short opinion, they write that they would support the bill only if it isn't amended into a so-called lock-up-your-safety law, requiring the use of gun safes. Does this bill put Wisconsin on the pathway to adopt a safe storage law? Are the two measures connected, in your opinion?
You know, I would love to see a safe storage law. I mean, this law incentivizes gun owners to buy a safe, and then they get to save the money on the sales tax or the use tax. But what we should be instituting is a safe storage law that requires gun owners to store them securely and safely. We know that more than two-thirds of all school shooters fire the firearms by getting them in their home or a relative's home. And so we know that when guns are locked up and stored securely, we can reduce the harm to our children and our families. So I hope that the next step will be a safe storage law. We've been too delayed. It's about time to have that instituted in Wisconsin, like our fellow brother and sister states.
So as you mentioned, 26 states have adopted secure storage laws, according to research from Everytown. Do you and your colleagues have plans in motion to establish a safe storage law in Wisconsin? Do you think that's feasible with the current state of the legislature?
I mean, I'd hope so. I think a lot of gun owners, responsible gun owners, say, you know what, I lock mine up. Shouldn't we have everybody lock their guns up so that children and any other unauthorized folks don't have access to them? You know, in my time at the Children's Defense Fund, where I was a child advocate, I worked on this issue, and I sat with too many mothers who had left, who their children had gone to a home, either for a sleepover or a birthday party, and their child had accessed an unattended firearm. And the worst nightmare for the mother had come true, where she lost her baby, because children are naturally curious. Somebody picked up the firearm and thought it wasn't loaded, but it was, and shot his friend. And so it is imperative that we become a state that says, we have gun owners, but we're responsible, and we lock them up.
Now, the sentiment among the gun lobby, as I just alluded to, is that requiring the locking up of firearms actually makes people less safe. Do you have a response to that?
That's untrue. I mean, the data is really clear that when we lock up guns, we have a decrease in suicide. We have a decrease in school shootings. Only good things happen when we lock up our guns. I can't even respond to that kind of response that people are less safe. It's actually the opposite. People are more safe when guns are locked up and stored appropriately.
All right, I believe that covers all of my questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think this, again, like I said, Faye, is the first step. I mean, you know, it's hard to be overly enthusiastic about this because it feels a minimal thing that we could do in the scope where we have so much to do to protect our children and families. But like we know, there's always a first step in any kind of change. So I look forward to seeing this come to the floor and seeing my colleagues on both sides of the aisle vote for it.
I've been speaking with State Representative Renuka Mayadev, a Democrat from Madison.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News on WORT. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of our show. Stick with us.
BBC News with Moira Alderson. Aid groups say 400,000 people have fled the Zamzam displacement camp in Darfur in Sudan after RSF paramilitaries took it over. Camps in the area are stricken by famine. The RSF move on Zamzam has left hundreds dead. President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador says he can't return a man that the Trump administration mistakenly deported to his country. President Trump refused to say if he'd follow a court order to help the man return home. At the same meeting in the White House, Mr. Trump appeared to blame Volodymyr Zelensky for Russia's war against Ukraine. He said, "You don't start a war against somebody that's 20 times your size." Harvard has refused to accept the demands that President Trump has made on U.S. universities. It said they threatened research and made new discoveries less likely. At least 1,800 people are suffering from respiratory problems after a sandstorm hit central and southern Iraq. It's also led to power outages and flight cancellations. The EU foreign policy chief says that states seeking membership of the bloc should not attend next month's events in Russia commemorating the end of the Second World War. Serbia's president plans to be there. Meta's founder Mark Zuckerberg has appeared in front of a US court in a hearing that could see the firm, which owns Facebook, broken up. US federal authorities are suing Meta, accusing it of unlawfully quashing competition. The US semiconductor maker NVIDIA plans to build AI servers worth as much as $500 billion in the US over 4 years. It's the latest tech firm to back Donald Trump's push for local manufacturing. Police on the Spanish island of Mallorca have arrested two people suspected of selling exotic cats online, including white tigers and black leopards. 19 felines were confiscated and dozens of animal passports seized. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
I'm Mark Thomas, a retired union activist. Tune into the Access Hour Monday at 7 p.m. when I'll interview Mary Englem and Annie Havel about their experience as politically active working-class women. Workers' History by People Who Lived It on the Access Hour, Monday at 7 p.m. on WRT Madison. When we stand hand in hand, that's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union brand. Oh, would you have meant?
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Rachel Fields, here with my co-host, Sam Swartz. Thanks for joining us.
This week on Forward Lookout, the city is holding a nice ceremony to say farewell to outgoing alders and a welcome to the new. Followed that evening by an incredibly long agenda. Good luck, new alders. Host Brenda Conkle and Rebecca Kemble have the rundown on this week's meetings, including, as Brenda likes to say, a lot of reports, reports, reports.
Welcome to Forward Lookout for the week of April 14th, 2025. I'm Rebecca Kemble, and I'm here with Brenda Conkle. Hey, Brenda.
Good evening.
Hey, we're going to go through a big list of meetings this week. So let's start with the county. Earlier today at 3:30, the Aging and Disability Resource Center Governing Board met, we think.
Or maybe not.
Maybe they
did. I hope not, because they didn't have an agenda, and I don't think it's legally noticed.
Oh, well. Well, tomorrow we've got agendas. 10 a.m., the Labor Relations Committee is meeting.
Yep, they're going to be electing officers, and then they will be looking at what the scope of their work is. So this must be one of their first meetings. And then they're going to be looking at grading and interview panel report. And then they are going to look at reviewing some surveys and reports. And then they will have a discussion about employee involvement in hiring practices and process.
At 2 o'clock on Tuesday, the Personnel and Finance Committee's Ombuds Subcommittee is meeting. What is that?
I believe this is an ombudsperson for employees. If there are any issues, they can bring them forward. And what they'll be getting is the 2025 year-to-date ombuds update. There was a, looks like a link there, and I think if you put it into Legistar, you could probably find it, but there was no link on the agenda.
Okay. At 3:45, the Tree Board is having its meeting and talking a lot about a lot of stuff.
Yes, they have all their general updates, and you can find those in the blog. And then they have some discussion items, mostly around Arbor Day events and what they're going to be doing for that.
It's a jam-packed 2 weeks for them. They have all kinds of events.
Yeah, they do.
Check them out. At 5:30, the Public Works and Transportation Committee is meeting at the Alliant Energy Center and also online.
Yep, they have a bunch of contracts and usual typical things that they approve. So it'll be the ground, like grounds maintenance at the airport, some cleaning services, and then they have some leases for Joining Forces for Families, a roof replacement at the Alliant Energy Center, and then they have the contract change orders number 102, 103, 104, and 105 for the jail. So
making up for missed time,
I guess,
the last couple weeks. And at 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the Dane County Food Council meets.
Boy, this is a running theme. More reports, 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 and more reports.
Yep.
So I think that, I don't know if they actually do business in here, or I really do think that this is just a committee that kind of updates each other about what everyone is doing so that everybody is aware and they can coordinate their efforts.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is.
Yeah.
So, and that's it for the county meetings. Earlier today for the city, the Madison Metropolitan Sewerage District met at 12:30.
Yep, this is our Employee Leadership Council, so they're looking at some issue requests.
Okay, and at 5 o'clock, Landmarks Commission met.
Yep, they have two requests for certificate of appropriateness, one at 838 Williamson Street, and then another one at 2110 Bascom Street. Then they'll be looking at a certificate of appropriateness for 1344 East Washington, and then they're looking at a demolition at 2604 Winona Way.
And at 5:30, the city's Police and Fire Commission, PFC, met.
Yep, and they got public input from folks on the hiring process. They also had several groups that they were going to hear from about what their input was for the hiring process, and then set some more dates for how that's going to work. And then they got the typical fire department and police department reports, and then they were going into closed session for the recommendations about promotions. And then they're looking at the round one interview questions for the police chief hiring.
All right. Well, tomorrow, April 15th, is a huge day for the Madison Common Council. The new council will be sat, and we thought maybe we would have to have another reporting out on a coin toss, but the District 19 race came within one vote of each other after the recount, so no coin toss there. Congratulations to Alder Gucchieri.
Yes. So this is, there's going to be two council meetings. This one is at noon, and this is where they say goodbye to everybody who's leaving. And so they will be having some honoring resolutions for Juliana Bennett, Marsha Rummel, Nazra Wahili, Nikki Conklin, Amani Latimer Burris, J.L. Curry, as well as Charles Mayadzi. After they finish that, they officially adjourn synodai, which means that is the last meeting of that council. They swear in the new people. And then after that, they actually meet, convene as the committee of the whole, and they elect the council president as well as the vice president. And then they adjourn until 6:30. So this meeting can run a little long depending upon how long the elders talk. So they actually had to change the process so that they would have brunch instead of lunch, because lunch sometimes is until 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So hopefully that'll be an exciting day for some folks.
Yep. At 1 o'clock, the Building Code, Fire Code, Conveyance Code, and Licensing Board is meeting.
Yep. They have one project at 3322 Agriculture Drive. They will be looking at some sprinklers there. And then they are looking at licensing of private ambulance service to update their licensing requirements. So there's an ordinance, and it looks like it needs some updating.
Also at 1, the Deferred Compensation Committee is meeting.
Yep, they'll be looking at the Fidelity Plan Review and then the Fidelity Mutual Fund Addition Discussion.
Then at 6:30, the Common Council has a huge agenda for their meeting. Good luck, new alders.
Yeah, they do. I do think much of it will be skipped over, but we'll see. The first thing they'll be doing is an honoring resolution for Arbor Week. They have a bunch of ALRC alcohol license public hearings, and then they will look at allowing hotels and motel rentals of 30 days or more.
That's like Airbnb.
It is. I think it might be there's a new project on Wilson Street where they have like motels that are also apartments, kind of. They're like furnished more like an apartment. And I think it may be fixing that so that business can operate in the city of Madison. And then the mayor will be submitting the alder committee appointments. Hopefully the mayor is letting them know in advance, but some alders will find out what committees they get appointed to. And then there's some construction noise that will be occurring by the jail. The city attorney's office has like 50 items on the agenda. It's all people who are claiming excessive or unlawful assessments for their properties. So there's like 50 different businesses essentially that are challenging what their properties were assessed at. A couple other things that may be of interest: they're approving $10 million grant funds for the redevelopment in the Triangle. They'll also be setting the 2025 rates for sewer utility and stormwater utility. And then they will be looking at the possibility of having Metro staff be able to give tickets for people who do not pay their bus fare.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a little intense.
Yeah. And it does say only supervisors is what I read, but it's kind of interesting approach.
Yeah. Yep. All right. On Wednesday, April 16th at 11:30 a.m., the Madison Development Corporation Board of Directors is meeting.
Yep. And they basically get a bunch of reports as well. So they'll be hearing their finance report, their president's report, and their lending report.
And at 1:30, the Personnel Board meets.
Yep. And then they will be looking at their compensation study report. They're getting an update on that. And then they get a report on the position studies that have been approved through administrative actions.
3 p.m. on Wednesday, the Parks Long Range Planning Subcommittee meets.
Yep. They'll be doing their Parks and Open Space Plan update.
And at 4, the Madison Arts Commission Standing Subcommittee meets.
Yep. And they will be talking about their 2025 and 2026 annual grant review.
At 4:30, the Urban Design Commission meets.
Yep, they have 4 projects. They'll be talking about projects at 5001 Femwright Drive, 345 West Main, 3565 Tulane Avenue, and then 15 to 27 North Butler Street and 302 to 308 East Washington Avenue.
All right. Also at 4:30, the Board of Public Works meets.
They have a lot of their typical things, approving plans and specifications for various projects, and they have some change orders. They'll be looking at planning and preliminary design for Regent Street and Randall Avenue to Park Street, and then they will also be looking at a bunch of bids that they have coming in. They'll be getting their change order report, and that's about it.
5:30 on Wednesday, the Madison Food Policy Council meets.
Yep, reports, but they will be getting a special presentation. The presentation will be from the UW-Madison Food Equity Access Simulation Technology, or FEAST.
Good acronym. I love a good acronym. Also at 5:30 on Wednesday, ALRC, the Alcohol License Review Committee, meets.
Yep, they have typical operator license applications. They have a temporary license for Run Mad Town, which is the Lions Club event. And then they have a couple of change of licensed premises, one for Bree Stevens Field and the other for temporary for the golf tournament. And then there's a whole bunch of new licenses as well.
At 6 o'clock, the Police Civilian Oversight Board might meet. They might not.
No agenda.
But they'll be meeting later in the week anyway. Thursday, April 17th at 4 o'clock, Monona Terrace Community and Convention Center Board meets.
Oh, more reports. They'll be getting a report from Destination Madison, as well as the reports required by the Monona Terrace Agreement, and then more reports from staff.
At 4:30... the Community Development Authority might or might not meet.
Yeah, they're not even on legislature, this one.
Oh, my.
But they also don't have an agenda.
Yeah. Okay, at 5 o'clock on Thursday, the Zoning Board of Appeals meets.
Yep, they have one project at 229 Van Dusen Street.
And at 5:30, Downtown Coordinating Committee meets.
Yep, they'll be getting a report of the Mall Concourse Maintenance and Special Events. And then they will be talking about Downtown Coordinating Committee future planning and the Mifflin Street Plaza. They'll be getting a progress update on that. And then they have the State Street Pedestrian Mall Experiment they'll be talking about.
So two more meetings with no agendas, 5:30, notice of possible quorum of the Community Development Authority, and 6, the Police Civilian Oversight Board Reporting and Analysis Subcommittee. No agenda yet.
No agendas yet.
On Friday, however, at 5 o'clock, the Office of the Independent Monitor is hosting a community listening session.
Yep. That'll be, like you said, on Friday evening at 5 o'clock. And it's basically to provide members of the community to be able to ask questions and provide any feedback that they might have about the Office of the Independent Monitor.
So that's going to be not led by the board, but by the independent monitor, it looks like, but more members of the board will be there.
Yep, and it's all virtual, so.
All virtual, okay. Well, that's about it for the week ahead in local government. Thanks, Brenda, and thank you, Christina Leffring, for engineering and editing. Find more news about the week ahead at forwardlookout.com. There you can find a roundup of local news articles each day. And new newsflash, Brenda is bringing back the roundup of local government and community notices and announcements that aren't quite the level of a blog, but that they're just lists of what's going on. So for more information, check out the extended version of WART website and forwardlookout.com. We'll be back next week with more updates on the city and Dane County.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Brenda. Thank you, Christina. Keep watching.
This Friday, April 18th, is the anniversary of the Paint Creek Cabin Creek strike, which took place in West Virginia from 1912 to 1913. It was one of the most violent strikes of the early 20th century. Armed conflicts between strikers and the strike-breaking Baldwin Felts Detective Agency caused over 50 deaths, and the governor imposed a strike settlement by threatening to deport striking workers from the state. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has the story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time, for our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line, for the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long, for the Union men and women standing up and standing strong.
This Friday, April 18th, is the anniversary of the start of the Paint Creek Cabin Creek strike of 1912 to 1913 in West Virginia. It was one of the bloodiest labor conflicts in the early 20th century in southern West Virginia. The strike was the opening salvo of what later became known as the Mine Wars. During the strike, there were over 50 deaths, mostly striking miners, but also several company guards. Yet the true total may never be known. 1 month into the strike, miners' families were forcibly evicted from their company housing, and some family members died over the months living in tents, including a harsh winter. Prior to the strike, there were 96 coal mines at Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, employing 7,500 miners. The 41 mines on Paint Creek were all unionized, as were all the rest of the Kanaha River coal fields, except for the 55 mines on Cabin Creek. Locals had endured years of anti-union violence by the company. The strike was sparked when the companies rejected Paint Creek miners' demand for a pay increase equal to other area union miners. The strike was on and quickly spread to nearby non-union Cabin Creek and beyond. The strikers drew up a list of 7 demands. 1. That the operators accept and recognize the union. 2. The miners' right to free speech and peaceable assembly be restored. 3. That blacklisting discharge workers be stopped. 4. That compulsory trading at company stores be ended. 5. That wooden mine supports called cribbing be discontinued, and that a ton of mined coal be considered equal to 2,000 pounds. That scales be installed at mines to weigh the tonnage extracted by the miners. That miners be allowed to employ their own check weightmen to check against the weights found by the company check weighmen as provided by law. 7. That the 2 check weighmen determine all docking penalties. The United Mine Workers pledged its full support. The strike's first month was peaceful. However, on May 10th, the companies brought in the notorious Baldwin Felts Detective Agency to break the strike. More than 300 Baldwin Felts agents built machine gun emplacements and evicted strikers, and the company began importing non-union workers, scabs. The miners secured weapons of their own. Mother Jones arrived in June, and other labor activists and Socialist Party members came to support the strike. Guerrilla warfare and pitched battles ensued, inflicting significant casualties on both sides. Mother Jones organized a secret march to the Charleston state capital of 3,000 armed strikers. In September, in an unprecedented move, Governor Glasscock imposed martial law on the district. On February 7, 1913, after another attack on the mine guards, the county sheriff and a group of guards responded by attacking the miners' tent city with an armored train called the Bull Moose, special for Teddy Roosevelt. Guards shot from the train with machine guns and high-powered rifles. In one case, 100 machine gun bullets hit a striker's house, killing him. Sarah Blizzard, a wife of a striker, led a group of women to tear up the tracks, preventing a second attack. Over the course of the strike, police arrested over 200 miners and their allies, including the 86-year-old Mother Jones. In a flagrant abuse of their rights, military courts were used to try over 100. They were court-martialed and sentenced to prison terms. Mother Jones rejected the legitimacy of the military tribunal and refused to enter a plea. She was sentenced to 20 years for inciting to riot, but her real crime was organizing the miners. She was arrested while reading the Declaration of Independence to an assembled crowd. While enduring the harsh conditions of a military camp, she contracted pneumonia. Glasscock's successor, Henry D. Hatfield, acted in a heavy-handed manner when he imposed a settlement on the strike. Although the terms were slightly better for the strikers than for the company, although Governor Hatfield pardoned the majority of the defendants, he kept the most radical strike supporters in jail without charges and sent the National Guard to close the socialist newspapers in nearby Charleston and Huntington. Hatfield's action led to a 1913 U.S. Senate inquiry, the first investigation into a state government's actions by Congress. Still, Hatfield eventually pardoned Mother Jones, along with 30 others, and got her to a hospital. Under threat of deportation from the state, the Paint Creek miners accepted the deal on May 1st. The Cabin Creek miners resisted longer, signing the deal at the end of July. The Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strike leaders went on to lead the mine wars in the early 20s, culminating in the massive armed march on Logan and the Battle of Blair Mountain. But those are stories for another day. For the past is the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's now 6:52 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
And Harry's back, reviewing a new series and recalling a movie classic. Zero Day is a new dystopian series speculating on the aftermath of a deadly cyber attack on the United States. Harry says it's pretty absorbing. And on a lighter note, Harry rewatched the 1988 comedy classic Who Framed Roger Rabbit. He says it's well worth revisiting or watching for the first time.
Absolute nationwide terror.
Computer systems completely hijacked.
A significant number of casualties.
Every phone in America displayed the same haunting message. This will happen again.
And that was a clip from the trailer for Zero Day, a new 6-part series co-created and directed by Leslie Linkletter. Co-creators and fellow executive producers are Noel Oppenheim, a former president of NBC News, and Michael Schmidt, an investigative reporter for the New York Times Washington Bureau. Zero Day is a pretty good, well-filmed series with an A-list cast headed by Robert De Niro, who plays former President George Mullen. As our story opens, Mullen is bored, retired in a secure royal estate. His biggest problem is writer's block. He doesn't really want to explain his son's death and why he didn't run for an almost guaranteed second term. But all that changes when the nation is hit by a cyber attack. For 1 minute, the power grid goes down, planes, trains, and subways crash. 3,400 people are killed. An alert appears on everyone's cell phone. This will happen again. Millions are panicked and look to the government to do something. The nation is starkly divided, not all that unlike today, with two extreme clashing visions for the nation. It does not look like the center will hold. Conspiracy theories are rampant, and big swaths of the population don't believe there's an objective truth anymore. In this sudden disaster, President Evelyn Mitchell, a great Angela Bassett, decides to appoint an emergency commission with extra constitutional powers to find the guilty parties. She feels the only person the country will trust with the job is Mullen. Mullen is the last leader to get things done and has the goodwill of the general public. Mullen doesn't want the job, but feels duty-bound to take it. Also, he feels he would be the only person not to abuse the commission's powers. Even Mullen's appointment has opposition, though, including his daughter, Alexandra Alex Mullen, Lizzie Kaplan, now a liberal congresswoman, and the manipulative House Speaker, Richard Dreyer, Matthew Modine. Alex thinks her dad isn't up to the job and doesn't recognize how much the nation has changed since he was president. Mullen reluctantly takes the job and faces a rocky road to the truth, coming face to face with his own doubts and mental challenges. All in all, a well-done six-part series with a conclusion that is a little too pat, worth the watch. Largely for the great cast, especially De Niro. Some of the cast is underutilized, though, especially Sheila, Joan Allen, as Mullen's pragmatic spouse. Up next, a classic comedy that combines live action and cartoon characters.
This is the tale of an up-and-coming movie star named Roger Rabbit and a down-and-out private detective
and stay out!
Named Eddie Valiant.
That was a clip from the trailer for Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 1988, a great comedy directed by Roger Zemeckis, Back to the Future, and Richard Williams, an Academy Award winner for A Christmas Carol, 1972, as director of animation. The project joined together Disney and Steven Spielberg's companies to produce a unique, cutting-edge combination of live actors and animated characters. The screenplay is by Jeffrey Price and Peter Seaman. It's loosely based on the book Who Censored Roger Rabbit by Gary K. Wolfe. This wonderful story is set largely on the grounds of the mythical Maroon Studio, circa 1947, a seedy L.A. neighborhood, and ends in the lively Toonland. Toonland is, of course, where all the cartoon characters live when they aren't working for peanuts, literally when it comes to Dumbo, figuratively for the others. Amazingly, in a few minutes, we have all bought the premise of a world where toons and people coexist in an unequal relationship. This is due in no small part to the conviction of the live-action actors, especially a great Bob Hoskins, as a seedy, down-on-his-luck detective, Eddie Valiant, who walks around the maroon lot, squeezing by a tutu'd hippo and avoiding getting his feet wet by a squad of brooms from Fantasia. He's there to reluctantly take the job offer of the studio head, R.K. Maroon, Alan Tilvern. Maroon's star actor, Roger Rabbit, voiced by lively stand-up comic Charles Fletcher, can't do his job. Roger sees stars, not birds, when he's struck by a refrigerator at the end of a particularly funny slapstick scene. Roger's acting in an animated movie. He's supposed to be watching a baby, but of course everything goes disastrously wrong. Toons, it seems, are virtually indestructible. Eddie takes the job, even though he hates toons, and ends up in an unlikely adventure with Roger Rabbit. There's some fun scenes, especially involving the interplay of Roger and Eddie, and a great villain, Judge Doom, the always wonderful Christopher Lloyd, as a live-action character. Also hysterical is the seductive tune Jessica, an uncredited vocal appearance by Kathleen Turner as Roger's spouse. All in all, a fun classic worth rewatching. It's available on Disney Plus. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
Harry, thank you. That'll do it for our show. Thanks so much for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Shayna Clark and Elliot Hughes were your reporters. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Harry Richardson, Brenda Conkle, Rebecca Kemble, and Christina Leffering. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast. And Shelley Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most free-form show on your radio dial. It's called The Access Hour. Have a great night.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Support for this program comes from Greater Madison Music City. Through proven strategies, success stories, and challenges, the Music City Circuit, presented by Greater Madison Music City, will highlight music tourism's role as a driver of urban transformation, offering valuable insights on how to shape our future as a music city while empowering our local musicians and music-related businesses. The Music City Circuit, coming soon to select streaming platforms. More information at ourgmmc.org.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.